Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this first hour of the show, we'll be talking about American traditional music and presenting some of it to you. And we have as our guest a man who for some time now has been interested in collecting and performing that music. His name is Alan Jabbour. He is not too long ago retired as director of the American Folklore Center at the Library of Congress. And for much longer than that has been playing music on the violin, starting out with classical music. He started playing violin when he was 7. He played in a number of orchestras, including the Miami Symphony and the University of Miami String Quartet. And when he was doing graduate work at Duke, he became interested in folk music and folklore. And for a time in the late 60s, he made a number of trips to North Carolina and Virginia and West Virginia to record instrumental music there, song and also folklore. And as part of that process, he became interested in not just collecting that music, but also playing the music, and started to play the fiddle under the influence of a number of people there he met. In particular, a man named Henry Reed, who was a master fiddler who lived in Virginia, who at the time was in his 80s. As our guest began to learn more of this regional fiddling style, he joined together with 3 other musicians to form a band that was devoted to playing these old-time tunes, and that was the Hollow Rock String Band. Maybe some people listening will know about that band. He got his PhD and taught English folklore and ethnomusicology at UCLA in the late 60s. Then he moved to Washington, where he served for over 30 years with a number of federal cultural agencies. He was head of the Archive of Folk Song at the Library of Congress. He was director of the Folk Arts Program at the National Endowment for the Arts and was founding director of the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress. That between 1976 and 1999. He retired in 99 and at that time got a lot more time to devote to playing and is now makes appearances as a performer. He continues to teach, and he's here on the campus to give a talk. This is in the MillerCom series, looking at the importance of music libraries and archives in the cultural chemistry of America. And that will take place this afternoon, 4 o'clock, in the Knight Auditorium at the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory in Urbana. And all of these events, they're always open to the public. They're always free, so anybody who is interested in hearing more from him should certainly stop by. And here on the program, questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, welcome.
Well, thank you. We're great being here.
Well, certainly very pleased to have you here. So you started playing violin when you were 7 years old. Was that classical music at the time is what you
played?
Yes,
there actually was a little school orchestra in my elementary school in Jacksonville, Florida, where I grew up. And so they took me in there in 3rd grade and said, would you like to play one of these instruments? And I said, sure. And they said, well, which one? They had violins and violas and cellos. And I then didn't know that I was going to grow up to be 6'5 and a half, in which case I would have chosen at least cello. But I said, oh, I guess violin. And so off I went, and one thing led to another. Pretty soon I was playing in the local youth orchestra and then in the Jacksonville Symphony. And I kind of put myself through college by playing at the University of Miami, played in the orchestra and a quartet, you know. But I had already decided sometimes if you start something too early, you can see the downside of it a little more clearly. So I decided, no, I didn't want to major in music. Something more practical, English literature.
Oh, yeah, big money in English literature. Absolutely.
So I went off to graduate school at Duke in the early 60s, thinking I would become a medievalist. So English literature was still in the forefront of my thoughts. But one of the first seminars I took was a seminar in the traditional ballad. It was taught by a professor there, and I got smitten just studying the ballad, but more important, hearing field recordings from the Library of Congress of all of these amazing ballad singers who collectors went around and visited and recorded. I thought, oh, this is wonderful. It wasn't just that the songs were great as texts. It was that the performances were great as an art, a kind of an alternative art, not sounding like trained voices, but trained in a different way with different styles and different values. And that's what I fell in love with. So I figured, well, I played violin. I could go and record old-time fiddlers, just like these other collectors recorded singers. So off I went with a cheap tape recorder and started recording fiddlers.
Yeah. Well, then, at what point did you then think, well, I'd like to play this music myself?
It was very soon after my, actually maybe beginning with my first visit, because the fiddlers I visited, I mean, maybe they could relate to the idea of documenting, but what they could relate to a lot easier is the idea of just learning, pure and simple. And when the minute they found out that I had played violin, they decided to treat me as if I were there to learn. And actually, I was curious about it. So in a way, the fiddlers encouraged me to have the courage of my curiosity. And to out came the fiddle again from under the bed, you know. And I started relearning a new style and a new repertory under new masters.
Well, that was one of the questions that I had, was that having been classically trained and playing classic repertory, when you go to play this kind of music, whether there was some way in which you had to learn to play again.
It's very much the case that you have to relearn, because the basic elements of style, holding and drawing the bow and noting the notes, that's more or less the same. And so I had the advantage of having that under my belt, all right. Mm-hmm. But first of all, you learn in a different way. You don't learn using music as a prop. You learn just by ear. And I had to train my ear to learn, because these fiddle tunes go by fast, you know. But the fiddlers came from a world where you had to learn it as it flew by you. And so you have to train yourself to be very active learners by ear. And so I had to learn a new way of learning. And then I had to learn a new style of playing, because the fiddling style, it's a little vaguely like, maybe you might compare it to Baroque violin. But, of course, we don't know what Baroque violin really sounded like. Maybe it sounded even more like fiddling, you know. But now we play it in a kind of a revived classical style, which may not have sounded at all that way back when they originally did it.
Well, can you have your fiddle here, and I wonder, could you play a little something? And I wonder, could you do something that would illustrate the differences between the two ways of playing a little bit, maybe?
Well, I'll show you a tune that called "Soldier's Joy," which is a tune that first was published in the later 18th century as a fiddle tune in London. And it's part of the fiddling repertory of the whole English-speaking world, no matter where you go. If they play the fiddle and English is spoken, they'll know Soldier's Joy. But if you see it in print, it looks like this. That's the way it looks if you were to pick up the sheet music as it was published and just play it like a classical musician would play it. But Henry Reed played it like this. So, same basic tune, but the style is wonderfully different. So I had to learn that new style, the way of bowing, the way of playing notes that sort of, the American style of traditional fiddling sort of lilts along. You know, it's not grasp the difference. And catching that lilt, figuring out the complicated bowing patterns that create it, just learning all the little nitty-gritty elements of style, you know, that make it feel like you're playing like a native speaker of that style as opposed to a foreigner who has an accent.
Mm. Obviously this music came from, people brought it from Britain, from Scotland, from Ireland, from places like that. So it could be that maybe they played it more like the first way that you played it, but obviously somewhere along the line it acquired a distinctive character.
That's right.
Can you say where that comes from, or is there any way to answer a question?
Well, I think actually there was a kind of a revolution in instrumental folk music used for dances in the late 18th century, and it was really the new violin, the Italian violin, which was sort of democratized by being cranked out in factories so that anybody could have one, that sort of was the instrument of the revolution, you might say. And now I lost my thought there, but as this new style spread, it also was connected with a new style and new types of dancing, like the hornpipe, which was a new solo fancy dance. And the revolution occurred in all of the English-speaking world, but in different regions it took on a different character. Mm-hmm. And so in Scotland it took on a Scottish character influenced by the people who were, in effect, carrying it out there. In Ireland it had an Irish. So you see right away a kind of a divergence of the styles as each region develops its own style in its own ethnic way of doing things. And in the Upper South, the ethnic way of doing things included not just the British American immigrants or Euro-American immigrants, but it also included African Americans who contributed syncopation, which started very early in fiddling. We all think of syncopation as starting, maybe it came with jazz or blues or something. Actually, it started at least a century earlier with fiddling. But the fiddling was done by blacks as well as whites. And so they were part of creating the new southern version of that new musical revolution. Sorry, I gave you a whole lecture for your question.
That's great. There, that's great. Let me introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580, Alan Jabbour. He was, between 1976 and 1999, the director of the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress. In fact, he was the founding director. He also, before that, was director of the Folk Arts Program at the National Endowment of the Arts, and before that was head of the Archive of Folk Song at the Library of Congress, and has been interested in this kind of music, in collecting it, documenting it, and performing it for a long time. Was a member of the Hollow Rock String Band, has recordings. They made recordings. He's also produced other kinds of recordings of historic character, and so you can certainly go out and look for them. He is here visiting, and will give a talk as part of the Millercom series about music libraries and archives and why they're so important. Questions, too, are welcome if you'd like to talk with him. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, when we talked a little bit about the fact that when you were in doing grad work, you got interested in going out yourself, doing some collecting,
right,
as people had done before you, going out with a tape recorder, right, and trying to preserve this music while the people who were doing it were still around, so that you could, right, so that you could talk to them and record them. And that's when you met this man, Henry Reed. Tell me about Henry Reed.
Well, I met him from, once you start visiting fiddlers, you get, if they like you, you get passed along from fiddler to fiddler. And I heard a fiddler named Oscar Wright, who was at a fiddler's convention. He was playing some unusual tunes that I had never heard other fiddlers play. And I said, wow, those are beautiful. Can I come and record you? And so I went up to his home in Princeton, West Virginia, and was recording him. And he was telling me, well, I got these tunes from old man Henry Reed. And I thought it was somebody who was an old man when he was a kid or something. But I asked about it, and he said, oh, no, he's still alive, the last I heard. And so it turns out that Henry Reed was like 12 or 15 years older than Oscar. So Oscar gave me the directions, and my wife and I went down to Glenland, Virginia. It's right on the Virginia-West Virginia border where the New River crosses over from Virginia. Of course, it's been crossing over since before there was a Virginia. But never mind, we won't get into that subject. But anyway, Henry Reed, he said, oh, Oscar sent you up? He says, come on in. And we're just sitting down to supper. So they sit me right down to supper, and Karen and I are sitting there. They don't yet know why we're there. But this was an example of the unfailing hospitality I encountered wherever I visited old-time fiddlers. And I remember a lot of people said, oh, you got to be careful of those fiddlers. They're suspicious of outsiders, you know. I never actually once found a fiddler who was suspicious of outsiders, but I think the person who told me that was the person who was suspicious of outsiders. No. Anyway, it was a great meeting with Henry Reed, and he was then in his 80s, and he had a tremor, and I watched him try to drink a cup of coffee, and it was sloshing around. I thought, oh, this poor man, he won't be able to play a note. Even maybe he once played, but no longer. So he gets the fiddle up, and the bow is shaking, and I'm holding my breath, and it sort of scratches, but he noodles a little bit. And then he starts playing, and it was like magic. It was like entering this other world where the tremor held no sway. I learned, really, he recorded about 144 tunes for me, and an amazing number of them nobody else remembered. These weren't tunes he made up, but he just had this amazing memory. He was old, he had great sources, and he didn't forget. Mm-hmm. And so he was one of these amazing people you encounter as a collector who just changed the landscape around you.
That's one of the things that amazes me about this kind of music that has not been written down and has been transmitted by one player playing it and teaching it to somebody else who teaches it to somebody else. Right. A lot of these tunes are very complex, and the idea that you could do it that way and have some coherence in the tune over generations is amazing to me.
It's amazing to see. It happens. But there is variation, too. And the variation is, in a way, helped keep it all alive, because the variation enabled the tunes to get modified in ways that were more comfortable to people and therefore to last longer. But you're right. It's astonishing that you can recognize them all, but many of them are easily traceable right back to the late 18th century, but not to before, because they all seem to date back to that revolution, you know. And mm-hmm. then there's a kind of a gauzy curtain, and when you peer beyond it, it's sort of another world back there.
Hans, do you think that the advent of recording in any way froze things? Because what that means is, from that point on, once you start recording people, you're not simply relying on people's memories and learning the tune from somebody else. If you have a recording, you can say, this is the way that it was played, or at least this is the way that this person played it on that day. And maybe then people would be a little bit less apt to change things either on purpose or just change things unintentionally.
That seems reasonable, and I always thought that. But I have to say that tunes that I've taught to people, which are on records and easily verifiable, still change, you know, and then I hear them playing it, and I suppress this impulse. The folklorist in me suppresses the master fiddler in me that sort of wants to say, no, you got that wrong, you know. Mm-hmm. If they've got it wrong, maybe they've got a better idea, and maybe that better idea will help it to continue. I think what makes people remember tunes well is a lot of people playing it. And the tunes that get altered the most are tunes that just get remembered by one or two people, because then it's more subject to change and not to hearing somebody else that corrects you. So it turns out that the recordings aren't as big a corrective as just a lot of people playing the tune. Mm.
You brought along some CDs. Right. We thought we might give people a little taste of a recording on which you play. You want to tell us a little bit more about?
Well, let's see. The CD I brought of me fiddling is the last CD I made, and I made it with Henry Reed's son, James, as well as a fellow named Bertram Levy, who used to play in our band, the Hollow Rock String Band, back in the 60s. And so Bertram and I got together with James, who is Henry Reed's son. James plays a little fiddle, but he also plays wonderful guitar. And he says that his daddy sort of taught him the chords. And so he's as good as we can get at getting at what Henry Reed thought the chords ought to be. And so I think they've got queued up the first tune on the album, which is called...
Well, it went away. It's in the control room. What?
I can't even remember what the first tune is.
We'll play it, and then we'll tell what people...
Oh, then I'll tell you the name.
They'll tell you the name later.
Once I hear it, I'll know.
Okay. It's called... Oh, Shoes and Stockings.
Shoes and Stockings,
that's
yes.
It. All right. Guest Alan Jabour there playing fiddle, Bertram Levy playing banjo, and James Reed playing guitar.
Right.
Our guest Alan Jabour for a number of years was the director of the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress and has been interested in performing traditional American music and collecting it going back to the time that he was working on his PhD at Duke and became excited by American folk music and folklore.
Was led astray by it.
Exactly. He could have been a professor of English literature, ladies and gentlemen, but no.
I had to go off chasing fiddle tunes. And
well, that just shows you what happens when you expose children to music. It's dangerous. It's like books, you know. You never know where a thing like that's going to go. He is here visiting in Champaign-Urbana. He's going to be giving a talk in the MillerCom series on music libraries and archives in the cultural chemistry of America. That's today at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. This will be taking place in the Knight Auditorium of the Spurlock Museum on Gregory in Urbana. These events are always free and open to the public. Anybody who is interested in attending should certainly feel welcome. And questions here are welcome, too. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I think it's interesting how interest in this kind of music kind of goes up and down. There was, in the 60s, sort of a peak, and then it seemed to kind of taper off. But I think in more recent years, again, people are really I'm sure that there were people who were playing this music and interested in it all the way along, but
right.
I think that there's been, again, another peak of interest in music, listening, this kind of music, listening to it and playing it.
Yeah, I think with our national pop music, there are periods when the pop music is really strong and actually a little bit distracts us nationally from the roots, you might say. Mm-hmm. And then, I don't know, pop music always draws on folk music anyway for its energy, and it sort of takes stuff and runs off with it, and everybody gets excited. Then somehow or another, it sort of loses its energy, or this is my way. Maybe I'm a little prejudiced, but it always seems like pop music running on its own steam runs out of steam fairly quick, and then things get decentralized a little more. But, you know, a lot is changing in part because of the availability of modern technologies at the sort of low level. One of the things I'm going to talk about in my talk is how when media, new media are democratized, when anybody can do it and do it at home, it has a real cultural effect, you know, in the cultural chemistry of things. And nowadays you can burn a CD. It's no problem, you know. You can crank out 12 for your friends, or you can press 500 to dealing directly with a pressing plant and sell them, you know, in your garage band gigs. And you don't need big record company labels to market you. You can sort of do your own marketing.
Yeah, lots and lots of people doing that using the internet.
Yeah. It's quite astonishing how the new media they weren't devised with the intention necessarily of doing all these things, but then people quickly discover them if they have access to them, that they can do different things, and they just jump right on that. And the music industry gets flustered and looks like we've got to do something about this. But what they've really got to do is be creative.
Mm-hmm. We have a caller. Why don't you, if you go ahead and put on the headphones, then you will be able to hear the caller. Someone listening this morning in Urbana. We'll go right there. Line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
Hi.
Well, it turns out there's an active group of people who dance to this type of music locally.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. Do they dance both squares and contras?
Mostly contras, occasional uh-huh. squares. It's a mix.
Uh-huh.
The group's called the Urbana Country Dancers. And we dance usually twice a month, and we hold an all-night barn dance twice a year.
Oh, my goodness. Are there, did I by chance come on either of the twice-a-month days? Or
well,
I'll be here two more
Friday days.
Oh, I'll be gone by then.
Sorry,
but I'm glad to hear that's happening. It's been one of the things that was exciting about the dance music that we're rediscovering and starting to play is that people started dancing more in old ways. They sort of had to reinvent it. And so two ways of dancing have been greatly revived. One, old-fashioned square dancing, two, live music to this old-time dance tune repertory, but also New England-style contra dancing, which is long ways and rows, and it's quite a wonderful style of dancing itself. And now these kinds of dances you can find all over the country. It's very inspiring to see.
Even in Illinois, there and Missouri and Indiana, there are several weekends that I attend. Two in Indianapolis, one over Thanksgiving weekend in Chicago, around Memorial Day in near St. Louis, and in the spring in Indiana, and in August in Indiana. But it's quite an active group of people interested in that type of music and dance. Our dance is going to be at the Phillips Center in Urbana at 8 p.m. on Friday.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, I'll not be there, but picture me as fiddling along with it.
Okay, thank you.
Well, let me, caller, before you go, if anybody who is interested in turning up for this thing could go and go to the Phillips Center on Friday at 8 o'clock and be welcomed?
That's correct, yeah. The whole culture of the dance is to encourage newcomers. And so you don't have to bring a partner. You just dance. You just come dressed informally in flat, soft-soled shoes, because we dance on the gymnasium floor at the Phillips Center.
Okay. Well, that's great.
And you can get more information by just looking up Urbana Country Dances on the web.
All right.
Okay?
Yeah, that's great.
Thank you.
And the caller was very modest, and he said, even in Illinois. But I don't think even in Illinois is right. I've heard, at least for fiddling, there were great old-time fiddlers in Illinois from the older generation that I've heard recordings of. One whose name was, let's see, Pappy Sherrill, I think was his name, and he lived down in southern Illinois. And I'm sure dancing and old-time dance music are well anchored here, and I'm glad to see they're revived and going great guns.
All right. And anybody else who would like to call in, talk with our guest, Alan Jabbour, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I'm sure that, nowadays there is a range of music that someone would be willing to call folk music. And also I know that, within the music community, there's big arguments about what folk music is, and maybe everybody has their definition, and then there are people willing to put them up and say, no, that's not folk music. This is folk music. Maybe I should ask first how you would define that term, and then maybe you could reflect on the fact that it seems to start a lot of arguments, and there are people who are willing to get really passionate about what they think is or is not folk music.
Well, I think it's folk music is usually thought of as music that's passed along orally and that has an oral tradition and style supporting it, that's not taught in schools, not through formal instruction. We learned the Star Spangled Banner, or we used to, in schools. But the Star Spangled Banner is a great example because now you can hear it in before every football game, and different people do it in different styles, actually intentionally. And so you could learn it very well without ever going to school. So let's put Star Spangled Banner back over into the folk music side. Now, I think the important thing is to think of these terms not as exclusive terms, but as ways of identifying epicenters, but there's a lot of flow between those epicenters. So if you think popular music is one epicenter and folk music is another, both of them are part of our musical life and tradition. But there's a lot of flow back and forth between pop and folk. The flow, pop music is getting ideas and energy from folk, especially style energy. And folk music is always picking up great songs from pop music and liking it. Oscar Wright, that I was talking about earlier, he played these great Henry Reed tunes for me, but then he switched off and he played Gentle Annie, which is a Stephen Foster song, but a Stephen Foster song that truthfully I didn't know, but he did. So you might say it went into tradition for him. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's, I guess, one of the things that I wonder is where that line is, considering the fact that there are maybe now things that we would say are folk music that were one time popular music.
Right, absolutely.
So when does something cross the line from popular into folk?
I guess I was starting out saying nicely that there isn't a line. There are poles, and then there's a blurry area in between the poles. But you might say that if people are doing it orally by memory and not referring to written sources to remind themselves, that's one good sign that it's become folk. If they're doing it in different versions, that's an even better sign that it's sort of gone folk, because it's sort of started to vary, and it's varied in different ways in different areas or amongst different people. And so these are sort of signs of it getting in the hands of the people, you might say, rather than being played from an official source.
Let's talk with somebody else. We have somebody here on a cell phone. Line one. Hello.
Hi. I just wanted to make two comments. One is, it would be very interesting if you look at the new Bob Dylan Chronicles Volume 1, which is the beginning of his autobiography. He calls himself a folk musician and says that he has always been a folk musician, in regardless of the guise of the music that he's been playing, he's always done folk music. And the second thing, I just want to tell you, in case you're not aware of the story, that you were talking about the Star Spangled Banner. I don't know if you're aware that Igor Stravinsky once spent a night in jail in Baltimore because he did a variation Star Spangled Banner, and it was against the law to make any change of any kind in the playing of the Star Spangled Banner. So I just thought I'd tell you that. Thank you.
That's a great anecdote. I mean, I'd never heard that story about Stravinsky, but that goes to show you that there's views of what is maintaining the sanctity of a composition versus the folk view, which you can see in a way the folk view when you see all the Star Spangled Banner renditions before the football game, where clearly people are trying to figure out how can I get in a few licks of my own here, mm-hmm. you know, and that's a more grassroots view. By the way, Star Spangled Banner was composed in the 19th century. So it is legally in the public domain. Now, I know those folks in Baltimore might be fussy about it because it was their banner and their harbor in Baltimore, but shouldn't throw a person in jail for that, for sure.
Well, and it wasn't original. It was not an original. They borrowed the tune from someplace else, didn't they?
That's right. Originally, it was an old drinking song. I think it was called something like Anacreon in Heaven. And it was basically an old English drinking song turned into a modern American patriotic song. Yeah.
Which I think follows the tendency of the time if people were writing songs, to take a tune. If it was a new song people weren't going to be familiar with, you could give them a sheet of lyrics, but you'd better set it to a tune that they knew. Right. So I think that was a fairly common thing, to take some sort of tune that everybody knew, but write a new set of lyrics to it, and certainly that was used in political campaigns all the time.
On the caller's other comment regarding Bob Dylan as folk, that's okay with me. I think these are fluid words, and they have lots of, how shall I say, we can look at folk as a big tent that admits many people under it. I think what Bob Dylan is saying is that he's always stuck to an idiom that's sort of a grassroots-derived idiom, and he's always derived his style from that idiom and tried to create new works using that idiom as a way of communicating. And that's his way of saying all of that is folk. Mm-hmm. Fair enough.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also certainly there are people who are doing string band music and writing new tunes.
Right, absolutely.
In traditional kind of styles, or maybe incorporating things that are a little bit more modern maybe in the tune, but trying to keep true to the spirit of the older music.
And old fiddlers created tunes, too. Many fiddlers that I ran into made up tunes, usually, sometimes by conscious noodling around, but usually, actually, very often by dreaming tunes. And so an old traditional way to compose was dreaming. And this has venerable roots in our civilization in many forms, you know, this sleep as a sort of a vehicle for release of creativity. We all know that, you know, dreams allow us to think creative thoughts that our realistic view of the world suppresses, you know, and I think that's true with music too. Dreaming releases creativity, and I actually finally had that experience myself, so I've observed and heard about and speculated about, but then finally had myself the experience of dreaming a tune. And it's kind of an amazing experience.
Really? Yeah. Could you play it?
Well, let's see. Actually, here's a tune. Let's see. This is a tune that I made up that I think I dreamed. And I played it for my kids. Let's see. I'll have to reconstruct this. Interesting story about this tune is that I dreamt it and got up and was noodling and tried to play it, and I taught it to my kids, and they sort of listened to me, and I didn't think they were paying attention. Then I forgot the tune. And this year, my son, who's now a grown man, he's 30, I was fiddling, and he was in the house with me, and it gets him to whistling, and he starts whistling this tune. I said, Aaron, where did you get that tune from? I said, I know I've heard that tune, but I can't remember where I got it, where I heard it from. And he said, Dad, don't you remember? You made up that tune. And he says, you were teaching it to us kids, and I paid attention to it. And so how about that? You know, I forgot, but my son managed to preserve what I dreamt and composed. So Now recall, that doesn't have a name either. We'll have to name it. Maybe somebody out there will name it.
Our guest this morning, Alan Jabbour. He is a fiddler and has been interested in his music for a long time, ever since he was doing his graduate work at Duke. When he became interested in folk music and folk lore, he got his PhD there. He taught English a little bit at UCLA, and then he moved to Washington, and he served in a number of capacities in the country's federal cultural agencies. He was head of the Archive of Folk Song at the Library of Congress, then after that, director of the Folk Arts Program at the National Endowment for the Arts. After that, he was the founding director of the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress, that between 1976 and 1999. Since retiring from there, he has continued to play and spends a lot of time doing performances and teaching. He's here to give a talk on the campus about music libraries and archives and the cultural chemistry of America. Questions are welcome, 333-94-555 and toll-free 800-222-9455. It's hard to imagine that with all of the music that has been composed since people have started, that you could actually come up with something that nobody has done before, or not somehow be influenced unconsciously by all of the other tunes that you've ever heard.
Oh, that's absolutely how we all compose. And T.S. Eliot wrote a famous essay on tradition and the individual talent, he called it. And he makes essentially the same point, that tradition becomes the sort of bank of creativity into which the individual dips. And so you're standing on the shoulders of all who went before you, and you're using their creativity as your launching pad. So of course you borrow from them. You add little elements of your own that make it enough different. It's not that, for me, that little tune that I played wasn't a great tune, but it was a fun tune, and the kids loved it. And I could see certain resemblances to other tunes that I play that probably gave me the framework for it. And then I threw in some little new things that made it enough distinctive that I could remember it. Part of it is being distinctive enough to remember it separately from the other ones. You know, so your goal isn't just to be creative in the sense that you're unique and unidentifiable. Your goal is to make it just enough different that you can remember it, as opposed to the ones that it's a little similar to.
How long was it in between the time that you made up that tune and the time that your son came back later and said, well, Dad, you wrote that?
15 years.
Wow.
You know, he remembered it. I clean forgot it, but it was in my mind, because the minute I heard it, I thought, I know that tune. Where'd I hear that? You know.
Let's talk with somebody else. We have a caller here over in Indiana to talk with on our line 4 right here. Hello.
Oh, yeah. Anecdotally first, and I have a question. I was down at Indiana University when their Department of Folklore took off, and luckily enough, a lot of people showed up, musicians, and got to hear, in a sense, the real thing on a lot of different areas.
Right.
Ended up on Chapel Hill down there by Duke, where you were.
Well, that's...
Anecdotally, when I was at Chapel Hill, my sensibilities never laid in country music or Western or anything like that, really. But I started listening to early music, and as I was moving up the centuries, I came across an album put out by I think it's called the Musical Heritage Society, and it had early medieval music on it, and there was a number of pieces from Scotland. I remember one I heard, it was like an epiphany. I just thought, my God, that's country Western music, all wrapped up there in about 4 minutes.
Yeah, that's
and
interesting.
And it just amazed me. Now that, you know, then when I heard the country music, I just immediately revert back to that epiphany and you know, sort of understand the unfolding of it, you know, to where it ended up in Kentucky and southern Indiana and things like that.
Right.
The question is this. Since you were there through 99, that means you were there during the Clinton years, too.
Right.
I was wondering, from the time you started to the time that you stopped, about government funding. I remember when, in the early days down at IU, there was an incredible amount of worry about all these things going to get out of our hands. We're not going to be able to get to there to record this or get that oral history or what have you. I just wondered what kind of hits that, you know, that cultural aspect of the United States is, has either received. Maybe it hasn't. I don't know. But I was just wondering about it from the time you were in, how the monies were put about and how that, you know, part of the economy was treated by the Congress?
That's a very good question. I'd say Congress is historically is of two minds about stuff like, well, folk culture. On the one hand, it's grassroots stuff that sort of reminds them of their own constituents and the special features of their areas, and they like that about it. On the other hand, if they're in a certain mood, some of them think of any government effort for cultural activities as kind of a waste of money. And so in different periods, there's been more or less activity or more congressional support or less. For example, in the 30s, there was a lot of congressional support for the archive that was developing there at the Library of Congress that I later became the head of. And Alan Lomax and his father, John Lomax, were there doing field collecting. But then in the 40s, because of the war, that sort of wound down some. And then after the 40s, there was kind of a period of retrenchment. The country had spent itself into oblivion, you might say, fighting World War II, got terribly in debt. And that was back when we worried about being in debt. And so the country, the Congress said, well, we've got to cut back on government and get back to normalcy again. And so right away, cultural programs, not just the archive, a folk song, but the Library of Congress as a whole institution start getting trimmed. But then by the 50s, that eases off and things balance back again. And by the 60s, the Library of Congress, the Smithsonian, start a period of expansion. And both of them, as major national cultural institutions, I think have done very well since the 60s, with ups and downs. But the overall picture has been a sort of a permanent commitment for the national cultural memory, you might say, through the library and through the Smithsonian. And the two endowments, even though they've taken serious hits, are still standing and actually growing again. So the idea of nurture of cultural efforts at the state and local level remains a living part of Washington. What people grumble about in Washington is that nothing ever dies. Once you get an idea there, you can't get rid of it. You know, so on the positive side, Washington itself is a pretty good memory bank for ideas for doing things, and whenever the coast looks clear, then these ideas tend to pop up again. Mm. So I'd say overall, the picture has been pretty good. Though, of course, there's been ups and downs, and some of the downs have been scary. I was on that boat when it was rocking, and I remember how scary it was, but we stayed afloat.
Maybe we could try real quick to squeeze in one more caller. Urbana, here, line one. Hello.
I just wanted to speak to the health benefits of this music. We sometimes manage to get to the Urbana Country Dancers, and I find that the combination of the music and the dancing and the focusing on trying to get my feet and my body going the right place at the right time lifts my spirits. And smiling at people, you know, you end up with all these different partners. So I just wanted to throw that little tidbit in. It's hard to be glum when you're dancing to this kind of music. Thanks. I enjoyed listening.
Okay. I'm sure it has cardiovascular benefits.
It has many. Maybe those smiles do as much for the cardiovascular system as anything else. But I do believe what the caller says, that that this is something that human beings do, not just to kick up their heels, but to exercise their bodies and spread their souls a little bit. And I think it's always had that function, and it's good that we haven't forgotten it.
All right. Well, we're going to have to finish. My apologies to a couple of callers we can't take, but people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, if you're interested in hearing more from our guest, Alan Jabbour, he'll be giving a talk on music libraries and archives and the cultural chemistry of America. That's this afternoon at 4 o'clock in the Knight Auditorium at the Spurlock Museum on the U of I campus, 600 South Gregory in Urbana. And, of course, you can go out, and wherever you buy your CDs, you can look for some of his music and music that he's...
I've got some with me, so come on out to the...
All right. You can hear him and pick up some CDs. That's
right.
Today. And just his most recent affiliation was with as founding director of the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress, 76 to 99. And he's still fiddling.
And fiddling even more now that I'm not a federale anymore. I'm just Citizen Jabbour, and I love fiddling.
Well, thanks very much.
Thanks, David. It's been great being with you.